this was created on the centenary of the Brothers Grimm, and that's why it's named for them. And it really was designed to recognize the emergence of a growing field and the legitimacy of studying books written for children as a field of literary study.
You have lobbied for, championed the idea of international consideration of different children's literature works. Is that something that still needs further attention, or is it time to move on to a transnational, comparative kind of approach to children's literature? What's the trend?
Folklorists have been doing transnational work since the 80s. They really have. So we have a model in place for that. I'm still concerned that in the United States, the vast majority of books that we get and that our children read were published in the United States by U.S. authors. And I do believe we live in a world that's internationalizing and needs to. So I will continue to advocate for more books from other countries to be made accessible to children in this country.
What does that bring? Give a couple examples of the kinds of cultural broadening epiphanies that can happen with a work from another country.
The Danes have some beautiful novels that problematize things like childhood darkness, that the way children can turn on each other and even enact each other's deaths. They have some very poignant stories coming out of Sweden. The Japanese have extraordinary tales of loss and grief and recovery. American children, U.S. children's literature tends to focus on the optimistic, the upbeat, and the happy. It's a legacy of our romantic construction of childhood. We still want children to be protected, and we still view children as innocent. And yet, if we protect children too much, we don't teach them resilience. We don't teach them how to deal with their own inevitable negative emotions, because no one can make it through life without experiencing grief. So especially the Scandinavians and the Japanese do a remarkable job of preparing children for emotional resilience, not just happy endings.
What can the African nations teach us?
We had a Fulbright scholar here from Tanzania, and what we learned from her was the paucity of children's publishing. She brought to us the books that are published for children in Tanzania, which is one of the more economically advanced countries in terms of children's literacy. And they were essentially stapled together paperbacks that looked almost like they'd been run by a mimeograph machine. It was startling. What the African nations can teach us is the importance of literacy, the deep, deep foundation of folklore and how it affects people emotionally still, the importance of the oral tradition. But it also reminds us of our privilege.
Let's talk about the oral tradition. Is the Brothers Grimm started out taking from the oral tradition and writing it down? And in children's literature, I think there is still that sensibility. Is that true, and is it carried out in other countries as well?
I'll take your question about the Grimms, because they were so influential both in Europe and in North America. What the Grimms did effectively was collect the tales of many, many people, primarily women, and they gave them a structured order. Their goal was to help create a sense of German nationalism at the time. They did erase the names of all the women whose stories they borrowed, which concerns some scholars. But in systematizing these stories, they also created tropes that we still see in our children's novels across the world, not just in the U.S., Canada, and Europe. And we see tropes like the child leaving home and returning home. A home-away-home pattern, we call it. And you see it, for example, in Hansel and Gretel. We see tropes of death and resurrection, as we see when Little Red Riding Hood is swallowed by a wolf, but then she rises again, just like Harry Potter does. We see tropes of eating and being eaten. Again, Hansel and Gretel come to mind. And we see tropes of the magic number of three. There's a lot of speculation about why three is a magic number in fairy tales, but perhaps the easiest explanation is it's a narrative structure. One pig makes a bad house. Another pig makes a bad house. Oh, we have a pattern. And now a third pig breaks the pattern, and things go better.
Well, the triadic approach is common in Celtic lands. It's common in a lot of things. We go from Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, Father, right. Son, and Holy Ghost, to yesterday, today, to tomorrow. We go to Moe, Larry, and Curly, you know.
Right.
It's a human thing. It's not just a literature thing.
No, it's absolutely not. But I think the Grimm's brothers were instrumental in moving that from, in their culture, a biblical triad into a narrative triad for children to understand structural patterns.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Roberta Treitz, the International Brothers Grimm Award winner this year. It's an award that's given only every couple of years and is a singular honor in the field of children's literature. You have a forthcoming book out from the University Press of Mississippi, 21st Century Feminisms in Children's and Adolescent Literature. Tell us about that.
Most of the last 20 years of children's literature, even 30 years of children's literature scholarship, was very focused on gaining legitimacy within the field. And so scholars were very much following the trends, the wider trends in literary criticism, especially focusing on issues of discourse and subject formation, issues of narrative structure, issues that involve and prioritize language. We did this very much to say this field is as legitimate a field of study as any other. But in the process, we forget that there's a material body. Children are physically embodied in a different way than adults. There are physical changes that occur in the transition from childhood to adulthood, specifically puberty. And in ignoring the material embodiment of the child, our field might have done a disservice to actual children. So I'm offering my book as a corrective, one that says, yes, the discursive is important. How we think about language and how it shapes our perceptions, we can't avoid that. But we also have to pay attention to materiality. We have to pay attention to the physical world of the child.
How should that be done? How should your objects of study change as a result of this sensibility?
What we're asking and inviting scholars, those of us who are in the material turn, as it's called, what we're inviting other scholars to do is to look at the intra-activity between the material and the discourse that shapes it. One of my graduate students recently did a nice paper on food. We think of food as an inanimate object, and yet when we eat it, it takes on agency. It gives us energy. It transforms itself. So, and we joke that, yes, food speaks to me. That chocolate donut is calling my name right now. We have an unusual relationship with food. Rather than focusing, as we have in the past, on the child as the agent who eats the food, what we're asking is for people to recognize that inanimate objects have a certain type of agency that also affects the child. Another famous example is Hurricane Katrina. There are several beautiful children's books written about it. Hurricane Katrina was a natural disaster that was made worse by man-made forces. And Hurricane Katrina had very strong material effects on people throughout that region and even throughout the country. So we're asking instead of thinking of language as that which shapes our experience, we're asking for people to understand that the material experiences of the environment, of technology, of inanimate objects, of the weather, that has an agency in the child's life as well.
And how do those experiences of a hurricane shift with the age of the child?
That's a very good question. Children who are too young to understand a force like Katrina might understand it better through metaphors of magic. They might understand better that there are certain things that we can't always understand. I want to go back to the Harry Potter books. For younger children, it's very, very hard to talk about the Holocaust. It's very hard to talk about the systematic anti-Semitism that led to an entire nation being, not an entire nation, but too many people in a nation being willing to ignore what was happening to people who were marginalized. I'm not sure I want to sit down and scare 7, 8, 9-year-olds with a story about mass genocide and with a story about horrible, horrible discrimination. So if I don't want to do that, if I want to slowly teach a child about the terrors of life, I can use children's literature as a metaphor. And instead of talking about the Aryan race, I can talk about purebloods in Harry Potter, and I can talk about muggles, and I can talk about half-bloods, and I can point out that discrimination happens in a way that might be cognitively easier for some children to understand.
Tell us more about how you construct your argument in the book.
One of the first things I do is look at eco-criticism and how children interact with the environment. I have another chapter that involves sexuality and how the sexual experience of coming up of age into sexuality is an embodied experience. I have a chapter on the dystopic in which I really look at how the human body is depicted, especially the female body, in dystopias where girls are often marked on their skin by scars or implants under their skin.
And it's not just girls, though, in dystopias. The body reflects the society in that way.
That's right. My focus is on girls because I think feminism has shifted its message. It has shifted away from a 1980s message of we're not paying attention to girls enough. It's shifted to the next phase of girls and boys are equal, to now a phase where we're saying the embodiment of the female is a different and important thing to recognize. Whether you're trans female or you're cis female, that how other people treat your body is part of your experience of selfhood. And finally, I conclude with an ethics of care chapter influenced by one of my colleagues in the English department. And I talk about probably the most important gesture that's happening as we talk about embodiment is a recognition that we must all be interconnected through caring for each other, for the child's body, that truly feminist behavior is always about equality and caring and parity and not about who's superior, who's stronger. It's always about caring.